Okay, so I'm here with Ricardo Ortiz, the chair of the Georgetown English Department, and we're talking about the question of why dork around with books or why read books.
Yes. I think I would begin just by interrogating the question a little bit, right? Because I think that I would wonder how much of this is really about the physical object of the book and why we need to sort of maintain a kind of core of attachment or commitment or fascination with or even fetishization of the book as an object. Because a book is not a text and a text is not a book. So if the book is just a kind of random or convenient or conventional shorthand for reading, we can ask ourselves whether we're just talking about why we read. And reading is sort of something we do to other things besides books. Another way that books often gets used as a shorthand, and you'll notice this if you just go through culture, especially back through the 19th century at least, when books became much more common and much more readily available and much more easy to produce, that books also became shorthand for certain kinds of books more than other kinds of books. So we can talk about the shorthand of a book when we think about like an academic textbook, but actually oftentimes in literary culture, a book is usually a novel.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And so when people say that they write books, especially in the course of the 20th century, it seemed that it was really just a way of not naming the novel when you really needed to name the novel, because the novel of all the major literary genres is the one that's most likely to sort of manifest in book form, or at least was when the book was sort of the paradigm object of literary experience, right? So I wonder about those questions, because I think if underneath that there's a larger question about an interest in humanities, that's not so centrally or exclusively tied to anything that's necessarily tied to the book or to books. It can be, but it's not necessary, right?
Right, right. So in a way, talking about the word book is maybe a sort of a bit outmoded.
Outmoded and also kind of charged, because I think it presumes that we're talking about people either who can afford books, right? And who really sort of still want the sort of the physical object of the book as the way that they mostly interact with the text that they want to be reading, right? And, you know, I grew up in the middle of the 20th century when, yeah, there was a very, very active and predominant sort of fetishizing culture of the book in place, and I was absolutely a participant in it. So,
right.
You know, but from the time I was a little kid, it started with comic books, but it pretty quickly migrated into, book form type reading that was either sort of directed at young people or not. By junior high, at least, I was reading grown-up books, mostly novels, but also a lot of nonfiction stuff all the time, just inveterately, I mean, just obsessively, and most of it for fun, not for school. So I was definitely like a natural reader and somebody who loved buying books, loved having books, loved arranging books, loved touching books, loved preserving books, loved all of that. And at some point, I would say, probably in high school, but certainly by college, I stopped caring about the book as an object so much and really mostly cared about the intellectual experience of the reading. Right?
Right. And that's actually like this whole thing at a time when people are reading on their Kindle or whatever. And,
yeah.
and then we could also start talking about all the other things we read, so, you know, like reading a film or reading an advertisement. But I guess for my purposes, I'm certainly not concerned with the physical book, because I sort of take it for granted that a quote-unquote book, I do mean novels and to some extent plays and poems, the sort of the canon. That's mostly what I'm interested in for this particular project. But certainly not the physical book, but I guess I would say text, this question of, and then, you know, when I start thinking about Rousseau or Machiavelli, those are texts that aren't, you know, they're not the novel, they're not literature.
Right.
So my categories get a little fuzzy there.
Well, no, and that's what I'm saying is that I think in a way my categories got fuzzy too when I started college, because by then, it was clear that, you know, even if we were still talking about literary experience and literary engagement, and a lot of that was still sort of driven by reading novels, the fact that it also included reading plays and reading poems and reading philosophical essays and critical essays and scholarly essays meant that the whole sort of world in which I was, you know, sort of circulating was really more about texts and genres and less about the physical object of the book, even though then if they all had to be in books, because there was no Kindle, and because there was no digital, there was no digital technology that rendered, texts, you know, sort of fluidly, sort of mobile across sort of digital space and digital time, right? So, the fact that now we're talking about a really, really different set of contexts where the text is much more profoundly dislodged from the book and from print, right, than it used to be. yes, we are now at a place where books increasingly will become more of a choice than a necessity. They will increasingly be more kind of a lifestyle feature, a feature of your sort of either your again your sort of fetishistic. And I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean that in the way that we sort of attach to some things over others, your sort of fetishistic disposition, or even just down to sort of like what you're able to afford and what you're able to and what you're able to collect, right? And so the fact that the experience of reading and literary reading is increasingly sort of dislodged from the necessity of its anchor in the book is a fascinating sort of development, and one that's still that right now is still sort of in the very sort of nascent period of its emergence into the world.
And it's also interesting the rise of this whole thing about the moth and storytelling, which is all the stuff I'm really interested in, which they're telling stories.
Yeah.
The people who are telling them often think of themselves as amateurs or non-professionals, that they're not writers. And the people who organize these events, Story District here in D.C. or the Moth nationally, they specifically say these are not for writers, these are not for artists. They can be.
Yeah.
David Sedaris does it, but it's also just for, Joe Person. And that's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is. And so I think in some ways... I don't participate in that process very directly. I don't have any impulse on my own part to participate in it, to the extent that I don't really have an impulse to be that kind of a storyteller, right? And to spin, especially out of the fan fiction spaces or any other spaces where people want to go, to spin, whether it's biographical narrative or other forms of informational narrative or even fictional narrative, right? My poles of attachment are still very much sort of in the canonical spaces of a certain kind of conventional literary reading and then a certain kind of conventional critical and scholarly response to that reading.
So if we're talking about those conventional
poles
or draws, which I think is at the core of what I'm...
Yeah.
What, conventional sounds pejorative. Traditional.
Oh, it's not conventional. No, you can just use it.
No, I'm just but it does have that ring somehow. I think a little bit, maybe incorrectly. But
it's not correct or incorrect. It's just a question of how you decide to spin it and what kind of you can make a judgmental statement. But it doesn't have to be. There's nothing necessarily
wrong about adhering to a convention.
We couldn't live without them.
Right. So what I was going to say about those traditional or conventional poles of attachment, which I like that expression, poles of attachment, that if the text that, if you're interested in that sort of traditional scholarly inquiry into text, what would you say to people? I mean, it seems to me, being very specific and local, people coming into this program who are, young graduate students I've met in the last 2 years, they divide really into two. People who are sort of interested in the non-canonical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, digital humanities or cinema or advertising or fan fiction or whatever. And then people are interested in more traditional works, but more contemporary works and not the quote-unquote old stuff.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to me who's interested in what. And so I guess for somebody who's sort of a doubter, I was friendly with, who said to me in the grad lounge, when I was explaining what I was interested in, they said, Edith Wharton or Henry James or all this stuff. And I was explaining that I had never read that stuff when I was young because it was sort of the 70s, and I was like, I don't read about that bullshit. Old, cliche dead white males, And then after a while, I think I just started reading, and really, it's very personal, I started reading enough articles in the New York Review of Books that referred to things I'd never read.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like that, that acronym FOMO, fear of missing out.
Sure,
who is the underground man?
Yeah.
Why don't I know about the underground
man?
I'm an ignoramus. So I guess that's my question. How do I explain to that person why should I or anyone else read that stuff, that old stuff?
Well, I think it's a question of the kind of life you want to have and the cultural space of the world that you want to live in and you want to participate in. And I don't think that there's, again, it's not a question of there being only one right choice. I think that there are a lot of different ways to be, constructive, productive, interesting, member of our species and contributor to our life. And so, this is there, and it's available for some, and there's no reason not to choose it if it's what you want. And I think that the worst that could come out of it is a kind of, conceitedness or a kind of arrogance or, a kind of sense of the development of a sense of superiority over others that's really not, ungrounded and not and shouldn't be based on this kind of...
I mean, arrogance for people who have read that stuff and say, oh, you're somehow less than if you haven't.
No, exactly.
Like that old sort of in the, as the, you know.
That it somehow makes you better than people who don't have an interest in it.
Right, yeah. And like the old sort of 19th century or 18th century, you know, boys club that, right, you could go to Harvard if you've read these seven texts.
Right. We just don't live in a world where you need that kind of reliance on sort of on exclusivity and esoterica and a sense of a kind of, of a sense of, of exclusion, of just being able to have been allowed into a world that only admits very few, and that those are somehow the best of the best and the brightest of the brightest, right?
Right.
So,
but it's so interesting. Did you read those pieces that those two interviews Obama did with what is her name? Who writes a lot about theology? The novelist Marilyn. Is her name Marilyn
Hacker? Marilyn Robinson.
Yes, because I was going to say Marilyn Hacker. She wrote Housekeeping. Yeah. And those two in the New York Review of Books again. I'm haunted by the New York Review of Books these days, I guess. It was really interesting because listening to these two people, not listening, but reading these two people going at it, it was clear that I didn't get a feeling of exclusion.
Yeah.
You know, they were sort of operating on they're both little eggheads and they were having their egghead a good time.
Well, I think that's it. I think it's a question of like, of sort of letting your egghead flag fly, right? And so one thing about this that's hard for me to sort of parse is just that I'm the recipient of that really traditional canonical education. You know, I was an English major at Stanford, and I took a lot of philosophy and a lot of Western culture classes, so I didn't have to come to this later in life. You know, I chose all of it. I mean, I think I was sort
early
of,
on.
I was conditioned for it through high school, but definitely by the time I got to college. You know, I went through a really, really traditional Western culture, Western Civ program my freshman year, and then I majored in English, and this was between 1979 and 1983. So, you know, those were years when the canon was finally starting to expand. And it was sort of before it really started to collapse. But the training I got was really canonical, and so it's just been the oxygen I've been breathing since I was 18.
Mm-hmm. And then for kids here, now that you're chair of the English department, what do you say? I mean, like you're like right now, what you were just saying is very non-judgmental and very neutral, which is great.
Yeah.
But do you feel ever that like students who come here just haven't? Don't have that training, didn't benefit from that, are missing out on anything? Because for me personally, what I puzzle
with... You mean MA students, not undergrads?
Either one, actually. I was thinking of the MA students because they've who I've encountered, but you know, this spring I had this experience of substitute teaching at a private high school here, Georgetown Day School, which was, I'm going to write about my capstone, which is really interesting. So this is a very exclusive private high school in D.C. There, supposedly it's not as traditional in its format as Sidwell, but it's still, you know, it's much more loosey-goosey.
Sure.
And they're very, I don't know if you know this school, but
I know.
So the chair of the English department went here. It was one of
Molly Chiak, God, who is it?
I'm blanking. Okay. I've been speaking to her. I mean, she hired me, but I'm blanking. Anyway, but...
Because, Molly is at the Cathedral School.
So okay. Another person I can...
We have a lot of people.
Good. Another person I can hit up for a job. Good.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because I had been thinking, oh, I want to teach at community colleges. Yeah. I don't want to teach these very privileged kids, right? But what's interesting doing this substitute teaching, and Maggie Develius was in the class with this woman whose name I can't remember.
Uh-huh.
So we were talking. The thing is, these kids... they're probably like the way you were in high school.
Uh-huh.
They have the lingo. They it's intellectually stimulating for me to hop into the class at the lab. I mean, I think of a substitute as someone who gets spitballs thrown at them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I was able. They had just finished reading Jane Eyre as it happened. They hadn't written their papers yet, and I'm obsessed with disability studies since I took Libby Rifkin's class.
Yeah.
I said, hey, can I do a disability studies reading of Jane Eyre with them? They'd never met me before.
Uh-huh.
They didn't need to pay attention to me.
Yeah.
They were like right in it.
Fantastic.
It was great.
Yeah.
So what am I saying? I guess I sort of digressed. I guess what I'm saying is, so what would you say to someone who, say, doesn't want to read Jane Eyre? She's not a dead white man, but she's a dead white lady, you know?
Well, so here's the thing. I mean, I think about this all the time. I was just an organic reader. No one had to force me to read anything. I read texts like Jane Eyre for fun, okay? So I'm sort of like the person, in some ways I sort of like, I'm the person that a certain sort of area of our educational system is trying to produce by requiring it in classes and telling everybody this is stuff you need to know, right? I think there has to be a middle ground. I think there are always going to be sort of organic readers and organic artists. I mean, these are the people who do it because they can't help it, right?
Right.
And that's there. That's the groundwork on which we're sort of, I think, playing. But the fact is that doesn't include everybody. And so I'm always fascinated by these students, by these young people, whether they're coming from high school or they're undergrads or they're even in our MA program. Who aren't like that, you know, who are doing it because they found a kind of just an intellectual interest or a sense of a kind of professional vocation, right? But where you know, given their druthers, they wouldn't necessarily always have their head buried in a book, right? But they discover that they're good at this, or that they discover that there's an interest in it that they like to pursue, right? And they also discover that maybe there's a professional opportunity in this, and so they keep sort of doing it. And that's just, that wasn't my story at all. Mine was just like, I can't help but do this. I might as well make it into a job, right?
Well, and then,
so in terms of like how we decide what material really is either required or compulsory, or you know, just without which none of the good things we want to sort of see happen can happen. I mean, I just think we've sort of settled into a middle ground where there's some concession to the fact that some parts of canonical material, of the sort of formerly canonical material, is still really worthwhile and does help students to develop a kind of literacy with the world that we want them to have, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you know, I think sort of, and it can extend beyond the literary. I mean, if we think about the larger space of culture, I think it's better if there are people who sort of, you know the traditional religions and know something about them, because they're clearly not irrelevant to the world in which we live, right?
And philosophy.
So from the traditional religions to philosophy, to a kind of like canonical tradition of literary and cultural work, right? But you don't necessarily think, you know, decide then that they need to know everything that's been produced, you know,
in that old-fashioned way, like
old-fashioned
the what is
way.
That called? I learned this with Eddie Maloney, the categorizing by like nationality or by century. What is
by
that called?
Any of that stuff.
Right.
It's more a kind of world of arts and letters kind of thing that's happening, right? A world history of arts and letters. And where, you know, there are giants that you're going to probably still encounter, right? And probably the...
Or miss.
Yeah, but let's say it's really hard to miss Shakespeare.
Right.
Who misses Shakespeare,
right?
It's not something that...
Right.
I mean, I was just, you know, I'm teaching community scholars, and we had our first meeting this morning, and they just sort of came out of the blue. I didn't ask. But because one student sort of volunteered, I asked everyone else. She had read, you know, Brave New World, Huxley. And a bunch of the other students, out of like 15 students, another 8 had said that they'd read it too in high school. I'm like, what? You're reading Brave New World in high school? So you know, Huxley isn't Shakespeare, but you see what I'm saying,
no,
right?
there's the new canon. Like, I joke that, you know, because I dropped out of college when I was very young, and when I went back and got my undergraduate degree, it was, I should have finished in 1980. And instead I worked for a bunch of years, so I finished in 1990. So by then, I think, you know, that collection, New French Feminisms,
yeah.
And, you know, so
yeah,
that
sure. Con,
that was like, I carried that around with me on the, you know, all around the Lower East Side.
Uh-huh.
It was battered. So by missing 10 years, that's when I came back. So it was interesting. I had two very, I've done everything late. So
yeah.
I did that. So that was what was in the air. Derrida and Lacan was very fashionable at that time, which is why I didn't really want to do a lot of theory here, because I felt I had done it. Now I'm sorry I didn't do it, but whatever. Because I told you, I was standing outside your classroom.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is at that time, Toni Morrison, as you were talking about,
okay,
the canon expanding,
right,
the canon was expanded then, but now it's Junot Diaz.
Yeah.
Everybody here in every class I've been in,
uh-huh.
And I love Junot Diaz.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I don't know if you read, Adam Gopnik had this piece a few years ago in The New Yorker about Trollope, called Trollop Trending.
Yeah.
It was great. I've never read Trollop.
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, it was a really, I think he's smart, and I think, you know, for a mass scholar is what I call him. You know, I think he's pretty smart, and he was talking about Trollop and why Trollop is relevant for our day, but Trollop is never offered here. I've never read Trollop.
Yeah.
I think I would probably have a very hard time reading Trollop.
Well, and even in the heyday of the most canonical formations of Romanticism and Victorian Lit, right? It's not like every undergrad was reading Trollope,
right?
I mean, every undergrad was probably reading Dickens, and you know, if we're talking about the early part of the 20th century, not Austen, right? And so, you know, I think that the fortunes of some of these sort of like mid-range canonical writers, right, has always shifted. That's never been stable,
right?
And so, you know, Trollope just enjoyed what popularity he enjoyed when he was actually alive and writing, right? And some of that sort of translated into a certain kind of continuity into the 20th century, but I think along the way, I mean, I just because of the Victorianists we have, it's unlikely that we would be reading Trollope
here, particularly.
Here.
But
yeah.
I think that's.
But that's not a structural impossibility. It's just a question of our staffing,
no.
Right?
No,
I
also think it's there's something, the shifting that happens partly has to do with the larger culture, particular.
Yeah.
scholars you have here. But when I talked to a friend of mine who teaches that, you know, she was a journalist and she left and went to Columbia to get her PhD at what then seemed very, the very old age of 38, and we laugh now because I'm in graduate school now 20 years later, and she got a job at UConn, the University of Connecticut Storrs. It's not a great intellectual bastion, but it's a very different,
it's fine,
but I'm just saying, but it's interesting because she talks about what her former professors at Columbia are teaching, what she's teaching, the trends are remarkably similar.
Oh, sure.
You know, like, no one's teaching Trollope at any of those places. And I'm not saying it's a great loss, I guess.
And he's still there. I mean, if you decide that you found a home in Victorian Lit and you really want to live in the the British 19th century, he's not unpublished. I mean, he's quite accessible to anybody who really chooses Trollope,
right?
Now, what the Academy has to do in taking up a responsibility to make sure everyone gets Trollope, right? That's just not even a question we need to ask anymore,
right?
But that doesn't mean that we're not, again, just to go back to the place where we were, that certain people are almost unavoidable, right? And so I would have, you know, if I finished my thought, I would have said that Shakespeare still seems to be one, and Morrison's another, you know, and that's where we are, and we've been there for 40 years. And among the sort of writers that are likeliest, that people are likeliest to encounter, there are a number of other names, and I'm gratified to know that Juno might sort of appear as a kind of really recent, fresh example.
I think so.
But I think he's actually, my sense is that there's going to be a much bigger crowd around him because this generation of writers is just so amazing. There's so many more of them just sort of appearing with a first or second novel and winning a major prize that, I mean, to me, he's still unique. I think he's still trying to do a kind of Joycean thing with his career that feels to me really, really ambitious, right? But I just finished reading the first part of A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James.
Yes, I'm dying to read that book.
Yeah, it's a really hard slog, but it's really
Is it?
Amazing.
I have it at
it's
home really on my night table, yeah.
And right now I actually had to go back because I'm helping a student with a thesis and he's doing it on Chabon, so I'm reading the Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, you know, and he's older than Juno, right?
Right.
There's this sort of just, there's Juno's part of a kind of roughly big generation of really, really amazing writers, right? You know, they're sort of the program era writers, you know, book.
Yeah.
So, and he's definitely one of them. But I think that, my sense is that there was something that, you know, that T.S. Eliot said in Tradition of the Individual Talent about the new monument, like the new classic sort of reconfigures everything that went before it in all these really, you know, important and sort of transformative ways. I think that there's a version of that argument that doesn't have to necessarily be so much about monuments and canons and classics and just is more about touchstones, right? Sort of touchstone material that sort of tends to sort of redefine the parameters of literary and cultural history in ways that, you know, redirect it and kind of reconstitute the terms. But that doesn't necessarily destroy the past or do away with the past, but just, revitalizes it, sort of brings it back into being in these new and kind of unprecedented ways.
So it's not seen as a hostile or,
because
that's the way it's often set up, I think.
No, but it doesn't need to be. No, it doesn't need to be. And I think that the smart artists are always really thoughtful about what relationship they want to have to the past and to tradition, and that relationship never has to be obedient or merely, you know, adulatory or respectful even. But it's always serious. It's always considered. You know, it's always thought through. And so, you know, if I say that it feels to me like Juno Diaz is sort of, you know, the reason I won't compare him to Morrison is that I think Morrison's a really different kind of writer trying to have a really different kind of career. And part of this might be gendered, but when I say that the Diaz's career seems to me to be taking a track that makes me think about Joyce, that makes me think about a kind of Joycean ambition that he has, right? I mean, it even comes down to, like, you know, Dubliners is Drown, Portrait of the Artist is Oscar Wilde, and We're Waiting for His Ulysses.
Right.
And these are two, you know, intellectually and aesthetically ambitious exiled writers writing not in their homeland, but material that's deeply embedded in their homelands, right?
Right.
I mean, the parallels are really amazing.
Interesting. Are you writing about that?
No.
It's interesting.
And he has said that Joyce is an influence, but what does it mean to say that, right?
Well, and it's interesting to look at them as sort of, you know, exemplars of, like, a new kind of canon, Morrison and Diaz, because they're not only, there's the gender difference, there's race, nationality difference, but there's also generational. They're not the same generation.
If you think about sort of, like, the form of a career, right? And the sense of sort of accomplishment across the different sort of phases of a long, especially a storied career, like a really accomplished career, right? Morrison falls more in the camp of a set of prolific writers who produce multiple masterpieces, right? So she's Faulkner, right? She's James,
right?
If she really wants to sort of take it back across the tradition.
Right.
I mean, the writer that I sort of pair her work with the most, who's her sort of contemporary, is Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, interesting.
I mean that's I'm not gonna write that book, but somebody should, right?
Yeah.
If you want to take two American writers who, you know, let's say started writing in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, if you think about an early text like Outer Dark on the one hand for McCarthy and The Bluest Eye for Morrison, and then you get to their masterpieces, so it's Beloved and Blood Meridian, mm-hmm. and then their late work. They really actually, they work incredibly well together.
Oh, interesting.
As a dialectic.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I know we're probably getting to the end of your time, but I just wanted to ask
you. See what we just did, right? So we're actually not even talking anymore about you. We're not answering
right,
that question
right.
anymore. We're just working around with books.
Right, exactly. But I have one question that sort of gets to the back to the beginning a little bit. So, you know, Dan Marshall.
Yeah.
So we were in Capstone together, and he, you know, doing this literature track in the medical school, and I would say to him, so basically another way of saying why dork around with books is, you know, what's the point of reading books? And,
yeah.
you know, and, you know, some people say, why ask the question? You don't ask that question about economics
yeah.
or math or whatever.
Yeah.
And he was saying that he was very hostile against something or somebody one day in class, and he said, I hate that word empathy, because I guess in the discussions of using literature in medical
yeah.
school, they always use the word empathy, that's what it should do for doctors.
Right.
It was like they wanted it to be sort of teleological, you know, so you read these books, it's going to make you more empathetic.
Yeah.
And, you know, Frank Bruni in the New York Times loves to sort of defend the canon and talk
yeah.
about his great Shakespeare teacher in, the, you know, Chapel Hill, and,
right,
you know,
right,
he
right.
does this all the time, which is great. Somebody's got to do it out there, you know, and
mm-hmm.
be the defender of reading books. But I guess the question is, and empathy is for school kids, you know, K through 12. Empathy
yeah.
is used a lot as character building. It's going to keep people from joining gangs and, you know, killing each
right,
other with knives.
Right.
And I guess I wonder, I liked what you said a while back about, you know, what kind of life do you want to have? What kind of cultural space
mm-hmm.
or space at all do you want to enter? I keep thinking of the idea of having an embroidered life or a textured
yeah, sure,
life
sure,
or
yeah,
a rich
yeah,
life.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's something wrong. I agree with Dan that there's something wrong with the word empathy,
yeah.
but I'm looking for another word.
Right.
Help
well,
me.
Well, no. This is sort of like, This is always the deep complexity and kind of, you know, sort of unresolvable ambiguity of the thing that we're talking about. So on the one hand, we always think of cultural work, whether it's through production or consumption, through, you know, sort of creativity or enjoyment, as utterly unnecessary. You know, it's sort of, I think the, you know, the in Kant, in, you know, and I'm going to forget the name of the essay right before he talks about aesthetics, it's purposive purposelessness. So it seems to be, it seems to have a point, but it's really pointless if it really actually, we could imagine living without it, right?
But what kind of life would that be?
Well, no. So that's not the next, that's actually not the next
okay.
point to make is we've never lived without it.
Okay.
Right? So the fact is that even though we can set up the hypothesis of imagining a life without culture, right, and without art, and without beauty, and without the aesthetic, and without the symbolic, and without meaning, and without all that other stuff, right? We've never lived without it. It's almost inconceivable, and historically, it's never happened. There's no civilization in this world, to the most primal, to the most tribal, right, that doesn't have a profoundly rich sort of cultural understanding of itself that comes through the symbol, that comes through the symbolic.
Let's tell that to the Republicans
in
Congress.
Since it's really where our humanity is grounded. And so, you know, it shouldn't have to defend itself. It shouldn't have to sort of account for itself. It shouldn't have to, come up with an alibi for itself. It's really, all you have to do is point at history and say, I don't see the problem. And so going back to, you know, the observation you were making about this, you know, about the moth stuff and storytelling and fan fiction and everything else, we don't, you know, it's not like culture is contracting. It's proliferating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I say this all the time, and I think everybody understands what I mean, but I think it's really hard to sort of get your mind around it. And now that proliferation is being driven by technology. It's not being restricted by
oh yeah
it, right
oh yeah
I mean what what happened with these new sort of technological, the first thing that happened with these new technological capacities is that we became more creative and more productive and more expressive and more communicative.
That's absolutely true, yeah.
And so, you know, my shorthand for all of that we're talking about is content.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's just the word that they use in the entertainment industry to talk about, right?
Right.
So I don't see content, you know, contracting. I see it expanding.
Right.
Philosophy is content. Literature is content. History is content, right? Religion is content, you know, to the extent that it's a set of texts that tell stories, right? And that teach lessons. So I don't see any recession. I don't see any sort of shrinking of the sort of the mandate, right, to capture content. And the capture of content is criticism, it's scholarship, it's knowledge, it's reading, it's enjoyment, it's consumption, it's all that stuff.
Pleasure.
It's pleasure and thought, pleasure and insight.
The pleasure of thought, yeah. This is great. Thank you so much. You must think about this a lot.
I live every day.
How do I turn this off?
I live and breathe this stuff.
It's great though.